back to Shattering Mist. Now that we have covered the entirety of Yeshaya 17 and 18, I'd like to propose a journey back through this compelling prediction, since it speaks so vividly as to what we can expect over the days, weeks, months, and years to come. This time, I would like to emphasize the order of the events and talk about what is being revealed, statement by statement. And while at times this may be a bit redundant to some of the territory we have covered in past program, when Yahweh reveals something this dramatic, this far-reaching, this relevant and unexpected, I'm unable and perhaps a bit unwilling to let it go until we have all derived all we're capable of learning from his prophetic dissertation. So if you're similarly intrigued, here we go again. Let's begin with Yeshaya 17:1, and we'll go through 18:7. It begins, a prophetic pronouncement regarding Damascus. Behold, Damascus is revolting and corrupt and will be removed from among inhabited cities. It is degenerate and unrestrained and shall be abolished. And she shall actually become a twisted tangle of rubble. It's hard to fathom, but 2,750 years ago, during a time when this land was alternatively controlled by the Hittites, the Israelites, the Phoenicians, the Egyptians, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians, and would later be conquered by the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Byzantines, the Ottomans, and the British, Yahweh predicted that Damascus, the capital of Syria, the longest continuously inhabited city in the world, would fall, becoming a heap of twisted rubble during the last days as a catalyst to a far more egregious war. He foretold that the Syrian government would collapse as well. His choice of words reflects today's reality, namely that the city's revolting and corrupt inhabitants would become as degenerate and unrestrained as the terrorist assaulting them. 17:2. Abandoned and forsaken, deserted and destroyed will be the inhabited regions and populated cities of Aroer, speaking of the outcasts in Jordan and Lebanon. For there will be roaming animals fighting in militant militias who will fail miserably, but then there will be no one left to terrorize. God has predicted that during this war, the refugees in Jordan and Lebanon, that they're going to succumb as collateral damage. It is exactly what we're witnessing, is exactly what we would expect. Addressing the outcasts erroneously claiming to be Palestinians, the very terrorist tormenting Israel, Yahweh foretold that the refugees' camps that they would inhabit in these neighboring countries would ultimately be abandoned and depopulated. This will occur, God said, at the hands of roaming bands of militant militias, not at the hands of a government. These terrorists, Yahweh revealed, will act more like animals than humans. Excuse me. Then he says, then the fortified places and the defensive structures will cease to exist. They're going to cease to exist on account of the northern kingdom, along with the government out of Damascus, including the remnant of Syria, before being similarly vehement and burdensome, fanatical, and onerous. Excuse me, I have a frog in my throat here. So he's saying that here, that on account of the northern kingdom, which would be the majority of the land that's associated with Israel, everything except Yehuda, which is the small territory surrounding Jerusalem, that its fortified places and structures are going to cease to exist. It is, he's saying that Israel essentially will become defenseless. with exception of the smaller, as I say, around Jerusalem, where some 70% of Israeli Jews live. He says that the government of Damascus, out of Damascus, including the remnant of Syria, is going to fall. Now, that gives us a prolonged period of time, because right now the government in Syria has the upper hand. Now, America is trying to end that by sending all manner of weapons. We're now sending surface-to-air missiles to the rebels. We see them, the rebels now, firing rockets towards Damascus. The rockets are American. The Obama administration made a deal with the Saudis months ago to escalate the caliber and quantity of and sophistication of weapons being provided to the Islamic Sunni jihadists savaging the country of Syria. And so unless the flow of American weapons increases rapidly, as we are witnessing, right now it looks like the government's going to prevail. But God says, no, the government's going to lose, that the Syrian government will fall. Now, for that to occur, either it's got to be another uprising, and this isn't the first uprising of Sunnis against the Shia government in Syria. It is the third such uprising. That either this one will be quelled for a number of years, and then there will be another. Or this one is going to continue to be vicious, and people are going to continue to die over the next dozen years. Because the fall of the Syrian government, as we read this, leads almost directly to the forfeiture of Israeli land that brings in a onslaught of Muslims into the Promised Land. And that forfeiture of land that is compelled by the United States of Israel seems to be coterminous with the tribulation. There's a harvest immediately thereafter. And maybe even coterminous with the event of the forfeiture of Israeli land. And the tribulation, according to this testimony, begins immediately thereafter. Now, the tribulation, if it's 7 years long, and we have every reason to consider it to be that length, based upon the prophetic witness, that means that it cannot start prior to 2026 in our pagan calendars. Year 5,993 on Yahweh's calendar. And as a result of that, this is going to go on for some period of time, at least 10 to 12 years. Now, Yahweh has foretold the outcome of this war. The Syrian government is going to fall. We know that the Sunni jihadists who outnumber and outman the Sunni Muslims 4-1 and now outgun them tenfold based upon the combined military expenditures on both sides, $165 billion annually for the Sunni nations versus $17 billion for the majority Shia countries, that the Sunnis are going to prevail after a long fight, perhaps lasting a decade or more, culminating between 2020 and 2025. The civilian population will be devastated in the process. Islam will be red in tooth and claw, vehement, fanatical, dim-witted, and enraged, according to this prediction. This, of course, means that the peace process will fail, as will diplomacy. Assad, who is currently winning this war, will ultimately lose. The carnage will grow from hundreds of thousands to millions. But this we know. The children of Yisrael, those individuals who engage and endure with God, shall actually continue to exist, prophetically declares Yahweh, of the vast array of spiritual messengers and envoys. And they will only continue to exist, this was 17:3, because God's going to intervene to save them, because the promises he has made in the past, to Abraham and to the rest of us through him. The region associated with the Northern Kingdom will be at risk initially, but as the nation of Israel as a whole is still going to survive the Syrian war. So while Iran may nuke Damascus as a parting gift for the Sunni Mujahideen who drove them out of town, based upon Yahweh's witness, there is no possibility that the Iranians will deploy a nuclear bomb in the Promised Land, causing it to be uninhabitable. And since Yahweh calls the Islamic assailants vehement and burdensome, fanatical and onerous, dim-witted and enraged, these fundamentalist Islamic jihadists will continue to act like savages. He goes on, the fourth statement. And it will actually come to pass in that day, at that time, that the size of Jacob, which is a synonym for the whole of Yisrael, will be decreased to the point of no longer being sustainable. And the fattest, best protected, and most vital midsection of Israel's body shall be leaned, shrinking in size. The prophecy doesn't explain how the proxy war being fought in Syria will lead to the divestiture of Israel's land. But we have a historical analog from which to draw conclusions. A similar war was fought in Afghanistan from 1978 through 1992, when America rented and then armed the Taliban and Al-Qaeda from the Pakistanis. These Islamic jihadists recruited and deployed sympathetic Sunni Muslims from all around the world to fight a proxy war against the pro-Soviet government. The fighting between the Islamic Mujahideen and communists was so savage, over 1 million Afghani civilians were killed, and another 5 million were forced to seek asylum in Pakistan and Iran. Their country, which was all but destroyed during the war, was further ravaged by the Taliban, who replaced the deposed secular government. Sure sounds like what we're trying to do in Ukraine, doesn't it? Well, this experience is set to play out again, this time in Syria, ostensibly because the world never seems to learn from history. But that's what we will attempt to do when Shattering Myths continues after the commercial break. We'll be back in a moment. I mentioned that the prophetic testimony doesn't explain how the aftermath of the Syrian proxy war leads to the world forcing Israel to surrender the West Bank. But I shared that we have an analog. We have a proxy war that we can look back upon in our not too distant past to ascertain what would cause the world to try to appease Muslims by surrendering portions of Israel. And the most recent proxy war was the one that the United States fought, using the Taliban and Al-Qaeda to thwart the pro-Russian government in Kabul. And what happened when American weapons supplied to the Sunni Mujahideen were successful in overthrowing the government of Afghanistan? What did those Sunni jihadists, a.k.a. Islamic terrorists, do once there were no more Soviet-backed forces to play jihad against? Something to think about, because we know what happened. It's about to play out again as a result of Syria, ostensibly because the world never seems to learn from history. But this time, the population is much larger in Syria versus Afghanistan. The location is much more vital in Syria than it is in Afghanistan, and the weapons are much more powerful than America is supplying. So we should expect that what happened in the aftermath of the great jihad in Afghanistan will occur again, but to a greater extent. And if you recall, in the decade after the Sunni jihadist victory in Afghanistan once the tens of thousands of international Islamic terrorists returned home, going back to Africa, to Asia, to the Americas, to Russia, and to Europe, they continued to be terrorists. They struck savagely on every continent, carrying out some of the most horrendous terrorist attacks the world had ever witnessed. And this leads us right back to Israel. Because the next wave of Islamic terrorism, consistent with the previous one, is going to occur. Because this time, they will attack Israel. Orchestrated by religious fundamentalists who will cite their Quranic-inspired hatred of Israel to justify their atrocities, jihadists will ultimately seek to destroy the nation they blame for their own poverty. And internationally, support for Israel will be diminished to nothing as the invasion is staged. As a matter of fact, the world will gladly sacrifice Israel, just as it sacrificed the high ground of Czechoslovakia to start the last world war. This time, however, when the Sunni jihadists return to their homes after prevailing in Syria, the carnage that they're going to perpetrate is going to be on a much more massive scale, and Israel is simply going to be sacrificed to appease the most ignorant, irrational, intolerant, immoral, indoctrinated, enraged, destructive, and deadly people on earth. Since past behavior is the most accurate predictor of future behavior, this is the most likely scenario. This is why Israel will be sacrificed. This is why this strategy will fail. The devastating conclusion of the proxy war in Syria will lead to a tsunami of terrorism sweeping the globe, and then to Israel's land being sacrificed in a desperate plea for peace. That's what's going to happen, my friends. Another affirmation of this tortured justification for abandoning the promised lands comes by way of the Iraq Study Group. In the midst of that war, when there was a civil war in Iraq with Shia and Sunni jihadists streaming into the country in the midst of the American invasion, which is a precursor to the current proxy war that has now erupted in Syria, the solution, reasoned the American politicians and generals, was to force Israel to surrender Gaza, then the West Bank, and Jerusalem to the Muslims, thinking that this would somehow satiate their bloodlust. But the first phase of that plan, it has been carried out. Gaza has been sheared off. We're just waiting now for America to shear off the West Bank and Jerusalem. With America and Europe supplying all manner of weapons through Qatar, through Saudi Arabia, and through Turkey, to the Sunni jihadists fighting in Syria, and the Russians and Chinese abetting the Syrian and Iranian governments, the consequence is going to be great. We'll be back in a moment. So, folks, it is inevitable, and it's all but affirmed by Yahweh when he attacks the United States directly in the 18th chapter of Yahshayah after presenting this sequence of events. That the United States, who caused the Syrian proxy war through its foolish invasion of Iraq, is going to try to satiate the bloodlust of Islamic terrorists that will be threatening it and the rest of the world by sacrificing Israel, tearing the nation to pieces. I'm here to tell you, it is inevitable. It is the deal that we will broker, and for that reason. That'll be the justification. As we now know, this outcome is already in process. But the final divestiture of land is not going to occur on the timeline currently demanded by the Obama administration. They want it now, and they're belligerent about it. As a matter of fact, it's interesting. There is an advantage of the skirmish in Ukraine that the United States is promoting. And that is that it has taken attention away from Israel. Secretary of State and the administration were both focusing on Israel, demanding that Israel accept its terms, that it retreats to the very borders that were described in this prophetic testimony, and do so at once, otherwise be subject to all sorts of international boycotts and economic sanctions, to be the scourge of the world if you didn't accept this divestiture of land that was part of the Kerry plan. But what's happened to the Kerry plan? Has nothing to do with it anymore. It's so far on the back seat because we're trying to make war in the Ukraine that it's not even mentioned anymore. And so there is a way of stretching things out. What looked like it was going to occur right now before our eyes, 12 years ahead of schedule, has been sidelined again because of the events in the Ukraine. Now, do I think that God is manipulating the events in the Ukraine to take attention away from Israel and to delay America's divestiture of Israeli land, making the country available? No. But when I see things happen in politics and diplomacy that would lead one to think that, wow, this is going to happen right now, not on the timeline that God has proposed, I seldom panic, because I know that God is not reporting a prediction, but instead is purporting what he has witnessed. And so you can rest assured there's other issues that are going to arise that are going to cause what God has said is going to occur, for it to occur when he has said it's going to occur. Now, as we look at these events, there is a realization that it would be very difficult to separate the peace treaty that appears in Daniel to separate it from the peace treaty that is going to divest the West Bank from Israel, making the country vulnerable to Islamic attack. Same treaty. In fact, God goes into great lengths in Daniel 7 and 8 to describe the powers that will be at that time and how they are going to be manipulative. He talks about their economic malfeasance. He talks about them turning on one another. He talks about their military prowess. He talks about their rhetoric, their nature, their mission, their heritage. And so, the same period of time. And therefore, this peace treaty that sends Israel to waste is going to be manifest in 2026, 12 years from now. There is another analog for what this prophecy portends that we have not mentioned previously, and that's Neville Chamberlain's forfeiture of the high ground of Czechoslovakia to achieve peace in our time. The British politician's horrific miscalculation quickly engulfed the world in war. God has told us the exact same mistake is going to occur again, and this time the colossal blunder is going to be sacrificing the high ground of Israel to the religious zealots that mirror the nature of the Nazis. Mein Kampf and the Islamic Quran and Hadith are extraordinarily similar, especially in their animosity towards Israel and Jews. Vulnerable and no longer defensible, Muslims will void the treaty with Israel just as Muhammad voided his treaty with his hometown of Mecca in the 7th century to justify his conquest of Mecca. Then, after promising to be peaceful for a decade in the Treaty of Hudaybiyah in the 9th surah of the Quran, Muhammad's wannabe God revealed that treaties between Muslims and infidels are not binding on the Muslims. So, with their God's approval, Muhammad set the example, the Sunnah, from which Sunni is derived, that all good Muslims will follow. The year following Islam's lone prophet, he invaded Mecca, just this time with a larger force, now that it was defenseless, better armed with many more jihadists, the first Islamic jihadist, forced the Arabs in Mecca into submission, known as Islam, beheading those who did not surrender. This is precisely what the Almighty is predicting is going to reoccur, but this time in Israel, just over a dozen years from now, with the belligerents being the same, Muslims. Yahweh stated that the treaty that emasculates Israel will not only decrease the nation's size at its midsection, but the result will leave the Jewish state unsustainable. If America and the Muslims, it is brokering this agreement on behalf of, get their way, Israel will be less than 5 miles wide, northwest of Jerusalem and east of Tel Aviv, where 70% of today's Israelites reside. It is an invitation for invasion. The statement in 17:5 reads as follows. Then it shall be like the gathering in and receiving of a harvest, of reaping the grain from the chaff in season, cutting it away so as to remove it from a vexing time of grief, thereby establishing and validating the standing grain. And with his sacrificial lamb, his strong arm and ability to shoulder burdens, his visible appearance as light, he will collect and harvest the first fruits. But it will be as a gleaning, a secondary, smaller harvest of years of grain in the valley of Rephaim, in the midst of souls destined to die. God has told us precisely when the harvest that will fulfill the promise of Teruah is going to occur. It's going to be coterminous with the treaty that surrenders Israeli land for promises of peace. It's going to be immediately before the Magog War, the onslaught of Muslims into Israel. It's going to come immediately after the fall of the Syrian government. We know the time. God is speaking of Teruah in 2026. This is year 5993 on Yahweh's calendar. There's going to be a harvest. And Yah's children, his covenant children, are going to be removed from Rephaim, from the valley of death. And that's what's going to occur on this planet at record rates. But right before the attack, Yahweh is going to do the following, the fatherly thing. He's going to remove the covenant's children from the vexing time of grief that is to come. This is going to occur on Yom Teruah, the first day of the seventh month on Yahweh's calendar. And since God transitioned from his declaration regarding the impending destruction of Syria to the immediate divestiture of Israeli land using the phrase, in that day, these events will play out in very swift succession, most likely in the same year. Once the Syrian war is over, once Damascus becomes uninhabited, a twisted pile of rubble, once the Assad regime falls, once the refugees who are outcast in Jordan and Lebanon are swallowed up in this deadly affair, once Israel is thinned, becoming unsustainable, be prepared to go if you are a participant in the covenant. And if not, you may want to consider its conditions and engage before it's too late. You don't want to be left in the valley of souls destined to die. Yahweh will accomplish his reaping of his beloved family, his first fruits, with his strong arm, his sacrificial lamb, also known as Yahusha. This smaller and secondary harvest will remove the children of the covenant from the valley of death, the killing fields of the tribulation. We can expect between 2,000 and 3,000 naturally born Israelites to be included, along with 4,000 to 5,000 Goyim, those of us who have been adopted into God's family. Throughout his testimony, our Heavenly Father makes this naturally born descendant of Abraham and adopted foreigner distinction regarding participation in his covenant. So this day will represent yet another promise Yahweh will honor. This one facilitating the benefits associated with the fifth of seven mikrei, of invitations to meet with God. The Father's troubadours are being called home. And so in him, speaking of Jacob and thus the Israelites and the children of the covenant, there will be those who leave based upon the choices they have made, gleaning smaller secondary harvests, as in going around encompassing and shaking them off as a means of harvesting an olive tree, two or three ripe olives from the top uppermost branch, four or five from her fruitful branches which have been separated, prophetically declares Yahweh, the mighty one of Israel, of those individuals who engage and endure with God. Those who are called out of the world at this time are described as standing grain, and then as ripe olives. The initial metaphor reveals that God's children are upright, established in the relationship. It also reveals that they have answered the invitations to meet with God in the spring, as barley is beginning to ripen, when Passover, unyeasted bread, and firstborn children, also known as firstfruits, are celebrated. The standing grain is distinct from the chaff, which is blown away. As we considered the nature of standing grain and what it represents, olives are also symbolic. They produce oil that was burned in lanterns to pierce the darkness and illuminate homes. The oil was used to nourish and to heal. Its light enabled parents to read and recite Yah's Torah to their children. And further, advancing the metaphor, the olive tree is not only firmly rooted in the land, it is among the world's longest living organisms. On this occasion, the covenant's children are being removed from a vexing time of grief at what appears to be the last possible moment. Yahweh is allowing his witnesses to remain and share his message with the world right up to the point that prolonging his children's stay would put his family in harm's way. The future for the vast preponderance of those who remain, of those left behind, is to die estranged from God. In that specific day, this man who is a descendant of Adam will genuinely regard and always accept the Almighty, his Maker, and his eyes will actually and continuously look towards God, the set-apart one of Yisrael. So then he shall never regard, accept, consider, nor look upon the religious altars, those works which fingers have made. They will not focus upon either the Asherah, the religious myth, representing the Mother of God and the Queen of Heaven, who is associated with Lord Baal, with Easter, Christmas, and Christianity, with Babylon, or with the worship of sun god images and resulting religious monuments. Yahweh reminds that with 17:8, those left behind, that those who have been called home will find heaven devoid of religion. Good riddance. It is vital that humankind come to understand that this life and death distinction exists, which is why it is being reinforced at this juncture. The earth will become miserable because of religion, and it's the lack of religion that will make heaven so enjoyable. The contrast will be palpable. Just as the world's most menacing religion, the faith founded upon deceit, death, and destruction, intensifies its indoctrination of jihadists, inspiring them to believe that killing and pillaging are a service to their God, the Almighty will be removing those who have chosen to trust him from his religious battlefield. But let's not forget about the billions of Christians who will be left behind, wallowing blindly in all manner of Astarte, sun god imagery. The rapture they anticipated occurred, but not under that name, on a different day. So that all of those who have disassociated themselves from their church, those who had chosen to embark on a covenant that these Christians thought had been outdated and had been annulled and had been replaced, are the ones that got to go. But alas, since this will be a small secondary harvest without a single Christian along for the ride, the faithful might not even notice. And those who notice the disappearance of 7,000 souls, those who will bring this to the attention of the religious and political leaders questioning why it occurred, will be misled by those who have crafted corruption into an art form and will have all manner of explanations, none of which will make any sense, none of which will be true. But the truth is seldom popular and lies are quickly swallowed. Collectively, these realizations underscore a stark truth the religious are unable to process. If God allowed them into heaven, eternity would be no different than what we are currently enduring. All of the grief, the perversions, the confusion, the conflicts, the denials, the pains, the suffering that religion has brought to earth would be transferred to heaven, making eternal life miserable, which is why the religious cannot be allowed in, why they will not be allowed in. Yahweh's proclamation is further evidence that religions are not spokes on a wheel that leads to God, but instead, through centrifugal force, they are spokes which lead away from him. Those who are gleaned on this day will have the covenant in common. Each will have walked away from religion, from politics, from patriotism, and from militarism. Each will have chosen to trust and rely exclusively on Yahweh instead of their country. These descendants of Adam will be gathered together and invited home on this day, Yom Teruah, the day of trumpets, because they answered Yahweh's invitation to be called out and to meet with him on Pesach, Matzah, Mukurim, and Shavuah, walking to their Heavenly Father along the path that he provided. I would invite you to do the same. May Yah bless.